This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, I'm Helen Lewis, and welcome to the Intelligence Squared podcast. You can sign up for regular updates about other podcasts and live events at intelligencesquared.com. Today, I'm delighted to be here with Jamie Bartlett, who is one of the UK's leading thinkers on the politics and social influence of the internet. He is director of the Centre for Analysis of Social Media, a collaboration between Demos and the University of Sussex, and his latest book is The People vs. Tech, How the Internet is Killing Democracy and How We Save It. Hello, Jamie.
Hello.
I feel like I've followed an enormous maelstrom of stuff that's happened in the last year, particularly, actually accelerated in the last couple of months. So let's start there and then maybe work backwards. I think the thing that I'm impressed that you managed to get in is the Cambridge Analytica story, which I imagine must have been extremely close to your filing deadline. But for anybody who's just seen the headlines about that, just, I mean, I think it is a big moment in Facebook and therefore the internet's evolution. Explain that story for me.
Yeah, well, actually, I'd been covering it for quite a long time because I covered it for the BBC as part of a BBC series. So we were sort of talking about this stuff 6 months ago. And when the whole story sort of re-broke again with the Observer's and Channel 4's work, we actually moved the deadline. We pulled the release date of the book forward 6 weeks because it felt so topical and we really wanted to get it out. So the timing is fortuitous, but not entirely so.
So what surprised me about that story? Obviously, Carole Cadwalader had an enormous hit with it, but I felt that it was a strange dual reaction going on, which was lots of people who knew quite a lot about how Facebook had been operating for some time were kind of surprised that everyone else was surprised. It was one of those things where we were like, I thought we all knew that Facebook did this, and oh, it turns out when you tell people about this, actually they are quite shocked.
Yeah, there was a sort of difference. Well, when you speak to sort of quote-unquote ordinary people who don't follow this, it did seem very surprising, and then there was this countercurrent of people saying, what? We've known for ages, and the whole business model is based on all of this anyway. And I think it got quite political because people started almost using it to say, well, Trump was elected on some kind of sinister set of techniques, and Brexit too, maybe they were involved there. And so it became almost a way of trying to discredit some recent political results that people weren't so happy with, which I think added a certain extra layer to it. But, I mean, the new stuff that I think that The Observer and Channel 4 got, partly it was because we had a whistleblower, so that's exciting, and Chris Wylie made one claim that was very important that I think a lot of people suspected but weren't entirely sure, which was that Cambridge Analytica may have taken data extracted from Facebook without user permission and then used it in their models, which some people thought that was true, but no one would stand that story up because it was all rumours. And he came out and said it flatly. Of course, Cambridge Analytica is denying that and they're saying we deleted the data. And then, of course, you had the Channel 4 undercover stuff. And when you have an undercover whistleblower, especially a whistleblower with pink hair, I mean, it really does make the story a lot more exciting. It's quite James Bond anyway. I mean, you've got Dr. Spectre, Kogan, Mercer, a scrappy journalist called Carol. I mean, it's brilliant stuff. But essentially the story, if I can just boil it down, is that Cambridge Analytica, a data analytics firm that one of many, frankly, has been building up very, very detailed profiles on millions of people, especially in the US, and then developing a specific technique that I think people are uncomfortable with called psychographics, which is working out personality types.
Okay, this is where I lose faith in this story.
Yes.
Because I just think that all that stuff sounds like bollocks, if I'm allowed to say that on this. But, well, not I think. I'm sure it is useful in the sense that all marketing relies on segmentation to some extent. You try and find your consumers. But what's different for me is saying that because someone's an extrovert or whatever, they're worth targeting versus some of the stuff that I know Facebook did used to allow you to do, which was kind of maybe, for example, using proxies for ethnicity, which I found quite worrying. You know, the kind of things that you'd essentially be able to say, you know, I want to show my housing adverts only to, and then rule out a load of lists of stuff that would kind of actually be illegal discrimination in lots of places.
Yes. So psychographics, well, firstly, there's no evidence that they really use psychographics, the Cambridge Analytica, that is, in the Trump campaign. They used it when they worked for Ted Cruz just before the Trump campaign, but not for Trump. And nothing I've seen suggests it was used in Brexit either. So I think that is a little bit of a red herring. It just feels very creepy. There is some small academic work that suggests that in commercial settings, targeting adverts based on personality traits can lead to a small but significant increase in click-through rates. But it's emerging stuff. There's no evidence that it works in politics. But that's not really what I'm arguing is interesting here, because I think that is a bit of a red herring. That's what people found creepy about it. Mm. It was called a psychological warfare tool. I don't think that's the story. What I worry about is the longer term effects of increasing segmentation of audiences, which is then used for more and more personalized political targeting. And that has been going on for a long time. It's all the parties do it. I imagine they'll all continue to do it. And I think it's fragmenting politics in quite a worrying way. And the focus on Brexit, the focus on psychographics, I think, takes attention away from the underlying tendency of where elections are heading. And I think that's what I worry about.
Yeah, I agree with you on that, because I wrote a piece about fake news before. I think it had just about been called fake news by this point in the run-up to the US presidential election in 2016. And what was kind of notable then is I was trying to decide why American politics is so much crazier than British politics. Obviously, there are lots of reasons for that. The Electoral College is just a very bad system for running an election. It overprivileges the southern states over the northern ones. You know, you have that extremely fragmented one, as you say. They don't have a version of the BBC, which I think is one of the reasons why the BBC is so contested at the moment, because that is the market square that everybody, you know, everybody's got access to. Obviously, the amounts of money involved in American politics are crazy. I thought I knew this, but it kind of came back to me when I was reading your book about the idea that, you know, Facebook and Google had people embedded in the campaigns, essentially. They kind of hired out staff because these people were spending so much money on political adverts, because you can spend so much money in America, that actually it was a big part of their business model. It was worth it. You know, Facebook had a dedicated, like, Trump account manager, right?
Exactly. $70 million they were spending on, Trump was spending on directed adverts on Facebook. And Brad Parscale, who ran the digital campaign, said it was the difference for them, that they could reach people they'd never been able to reach before. Facebook's own internal white paper, which came out after the book, or after I'd finished the book, said that their research had found that the Trump team, which included Cambridge Analytica staff, who were also seconded in, just used the platform far more effectively than Hillary Clinton did.
Well, that word effectively is really interesting there, because what they did was they made things that were more viral, right? They were more naturally viral because they were more naturally anger-inducing or reaction-inducing, right? And this is one of the things that Facebook is criticised for, and something that Google's YouTube algorithm has been criticised for, about a tendency towards extremism. So the idea is, if you watch a video on YouTube about something, it wants to hook you there. So it's offering you something slightly stronger, and that can kind of send you down a wormhole.
Mm. Absolutely. And that's part of the reason that I'm worried about the sort of growing segmentation of targeted messaging for politics, because its origins is much more in advertising than it is in technology, in a sense. And I prefer to see Facebook and Google as advertising companies, really, rather than tech companies in many ways. And a lot of advertising is about emotion. It's about, how do you grip people emotionally? Because that's what has always worked. And so the adverts that perform best tend to be the more emotional ones. That Facebook's own algorithm will prioritize adverts that they expect to do better. So they'll prioritize more emotional adverts. Split A-B testing will nearly always find that emotional ads do better. And it turns politics into a much more, both very targeted and very emotional. And politics has always been emotional in some sense, but we're sort of turbocharging it with algorithms. And it's often not that anyone is designing it explicitly like that. It's just a kind of reflection of how we operate as humans, and then given a massive algorithmic big data push. And that's what's worrying, because I think, you know, a lot of politics is trying to hold the line against sort of overly emotional reactions to things, and we seem to be going in the opposite direction. And it's hard to argue that politics hasn't got more emotional in the last 10 years, more tribal, more anger, more rage. And I think this is one of the things that's underlying that trend.
It does worry me that we're more heading towards a culture war of the type that I think America has been seized by, whether it is issues like guns or abortion, which are just the rallying cries. And actually, economics gets kind of slightly left behind in that. And I think Brexit has to some extent done that. It has polarised us around a whole set of assumptions that you wouldn't, you know, why should anyone support for the death penalty and, you know, whether or not they think gollywogs should be banned should be the kind of, you know, but there's a checklist of things you could almost run down that just seem very disparate, but you would say those are all the attitudes that align along one line.
Yeah, and then you're on the you're on that team then, and then you'll defend anything that that team does, and you'll start looking at the other team and saying everything they do is ridiculous and out of touch and stupid or whatever it happens to be. And that's Marshall McLuhan predicted all of this, this kind of return to tribal politics, because we're so overwhelmed with information, we begin to rely more and more on heuristics and emotional ways of managing information overload. And then argument and compromise becomes almost secondary. It doesn't really, it's impossible in that sort of a world.
One of the things I think was interesting that you said is about the idea that Facebook didn't design this stuff. But it also didn't not design it, in the sense that I think the big kind of lesson of the last 5 years has been about big platforms disclaiming responsibility, you know, which starts off, I guess, with the idea that if you are a publisher, you are responsible for, say, you know, libels on your platform. Whereas if you're just, you know, a piece of paper, you can't be held responsible. So they tried to push this idea that they would just, you know, they were just there. Who, you know, we're not going to take any responsibility for anything. And very much influenced by that free speech ethos of the internet, with all the early internet utopians thought this was brilliant. This was going to overturn authoritarian governments. And then the weird thing being that the big story of the last 2 years is an extremely authoritarian government in Russia has been much better at everybody else than at weaponizing emotion. And I was struck by the fact that Mark Zuckerberg, CEO of Facebook, has now announced that they're going to have a searchable, I think, database of all political ads, right? So actually, you'll be able to see. Hmm. And that to me seems crazy that we've got to this point and then they've only just sort of thought that might... I mean, you know, that's a fairly basic... Because if something's on a billboard that you drive past, everybody's got access to it and you can see what everyone else is seeing, right? Yeah. You can have that public space that is contested. But one of the fundamental problems with that 2016 election and Brexit is that you couldn't see what other people were seeing.
Exactly. And that's the problem with this type of network. And it's exactly the big worry that I have about micro-targeting. It's that the diminishment of a public space and the replacement with millions of private spaces that regulators can't see. The idea of a public commons is sort of lost. And I mean, how do you hold a politician accountable if he's made a million different promises to a million different people? But the idea that we are a mere conduit, as it says in EU law, is so fundamental to the sort of philosophy of these companies from the very beginning. I mean, the Communications Decency Act, from which this little clause was inserted saying that internet companies should not be considered as publishers, has been the bedrock of their business model. And there's a practical reason for that. It's that if Facebook were considered a publisher, they would have to be responsible for sort of legaling and checking billions of pieces of content that are uploaded onto their site every day. It's not really practicable. It's not really practical or manageable. And so,
hang on a minute. It's not really practical if you want to run Facebook as it's currently constituted.
Yes.
And I think this is where the journalist in me gets quite grumpy, because do you know what makes newspapers really hard to run and expensive to run is the fact that you have to take responsibility and you have to only try to your best of your ability to only publish things that are true.
Yes, but
and they've just kind of gone, we want to run basically just user-generated content and let 1,000
flowers
bloom.
Well, wait, you see, because what I was going to go on to say then was, before your angry, grumpy journalist jumped straight in. And it's amazing, because a journalist, this is a thing that for every journalist I speak to, this is a really important point, because it's like, why do we have to do all of this?
But also that they're making money out of it.
Well, that was the point I was going to say, because that's exactly the point. Because I think originally, when that CDA clause was passed into law, no one imagined that this would be a big money-making industry in the same way. No one thought that companies would be able to sell data against this content and essentially monetize it. It was just a way of nice blogs. The person that runs a blog shouldn't be responsible if some moron turns up and posts something on your blog. Why should you be legally responsible for that? It was felt that it would ruin the culture, the open internet culture and ethos. But obviously, now that we're talking about an industry that is directly removing money from journalists and journalistic outlets that have to apply very different and more stringent standards, it suddenly feels rather unfair. And so I don't have a simple answer for this one, because if we were to declare Facebook to be a publisher, it is quite possible that they would more or less collapse overnight. So, and there's obviously going to be a social cost to that. One thing that I think we can do, and one thing that I argue, is, you know, much tougher laws and regulations that force them to remove content when it's alerted to them that it's wrong. And, okay. and that's part of what they're also, and the other bit is, and this happened recently with Martin Lewis, that he was saying that adverts are being sold with my face on, without my permission. And that feels even more wrong, because that's the direct business. I mean, that is, you're selling adverts on your space without the permission of people whose faces are appearing on
it. So let me play devil's advocate for a minute. Say Facebook does collapse overnight. Is that bad? I mean, this is the thing, is we were told that actually having these technologies was, for example, very challenging to authoritarian regimes, because they were technologies that allowed ideas to spread. You know, there was lots of talk about the Arab Spring and whether or not, Twitter was helpful in that, with people protests in Iran. Now the kind of suggestion has come back the other way, that actually tinderbox regimes, you know, Facebook is responsible for spreading huge amounts of conspiracy theories on that. You know, it's pouring petrol on the fire of some pretty unpleasant places. So if it turns out that you can't run an ethical version of Facebook, you know, shouldn't it be allowed to die? I mean, that sounds sort of borderline Stalinist.
I'm the one that's supposed to be arguing about taking a tough line on these companies, and you're supposed to be pushing back. You're pushing me even further than I'm willing to go. I think that just before we do that, I would like to try to push harder on regulations so that they're much more responsive at removing content, being more proactive with the content. But being more proactive with the content that they struggle. So, for example, they can build better systems to try to automatically identify certain types of content that's known to be illegal. Germany has introduced a law where they are fined a huge amount if they don't remove hate speech content within 24 hours, and they will respond to that. They'll say it's impossible, and then they'll somehow magically manage to do that. So I want to try that first. And if none of that's working and we're still going in the same direction, yeah, maybe that's where we end up.
I mean, I've been trying to take a pause from Facebook. So a couple of years ago, I suspended my account because I think I was doing some reporting on someone like 4chan or some group of fairly unpleasant people that I thought were probably quite good at hacking stuff, and therefore I should just shut down my Facebook account and try and, you know, I've got two-step verification on everything, which I think you should do if you're reporting on any of this kind of stuff. And it made you go through a gauntlet of guilt where it would say, like, you know, Jamie will miss you, and then showed you a photo of your friends.
Yeah, well, I would have missed you, though.
But then now the thing that it does, because I decided not to suspend my account this time and just try and use it less, it knows when you've logged in. So it sends you, like, I find quite creepy emails where it says, hey, haven't seen you around lately. Or it'll say, like, ex-friend one has left a comment on ex-friend's two status. And I think that, you know, I think we have to address the addictive nature of some of these technologies. Because to me, the best analogy for how we should look at tech is fast food. Right? We evolved over thousands of years to find sweet things delicious because sugar was an incredibly important thing when you were, you know, subsistence farming, right? When you were just trying to scrape together the calories needed to survive every day. So that's what we're tuned to. Now what we've done is we've made in a load of food that has got huge amounts of sugar, and we've now tuned every recipe, you know, to have the perfect mix of salt and sweet and umami and all this kind of stuff to make you never feel full. And then at some point you have to say, people can't by themselves stop eating this kind of stuff. So you need to have sugar taxis. You need to have, like, the thing that came in New York where they had maximum sizes for drinks. Before that, you could have drinks that were like 2 litres of, you know, thousands of calories. You know, you need to have calories counts on packaging so people actually know what it is that they're buying.
Yeah.
And that to me is the same where we are now with information. Well, we've made information really, really delicious.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yes. And I mean, the opening chapter is actually about the sort of the way we've built these amazing addiction machines. Incredible amounts of money goes in, and some of the smartest brains in the world spend their lives just trying to work out why you click on certain things and what things are a fraction of a percentage point more likely to make you click on something else. Because every extra second you spend on the site – the extra eyeballs you spend on the site is worth a lot of money when it's aggregated up over a billion or 2 billion people. And so there's been this kind of industrial scale effort to work out how to get you to be addicted to these platforms. To me, that goes back to the origins of these companies. It should not be a tech firm. It should be seen as an advertising company. And it's been a centuries long effort from people working in advertising to figure out what makes you tick. Mm. And what will make you buy stuff. And that's what's underneath all of this. And I think that is a massive problem. And it militates against the need for citizens to be alert, to be able to focus on things, to be able to direct their attentions to what our politicians are doing rather than staring at our screens, to be able to think fully for ourselves. I mean, I kind of project forward the worries in 20 years' time when algorithms become stronger and stronger and more data about us is being shared all the time, that we'll be subject to so many micro nudges constantly that will try and sway us one way or another, that we will slowly begin to lose the ability to take important moral judgments for ourselves, because we'll lose the kind of confidence of our own moral positions. And I kind of come up with this weird sort of scenario of where you'll be able to ask your phone how you should vote for you know, in the EU referendum, because it will have scraped all this data and worked out what's really in your best interest, this moral singularity moment. And that really worries me. And I think there's been over the last 6 months, even, there has been a bit of a pushback against these addictive technologies, because all of us feel it in our daily lives and we feel that phantom ringing in our pocket and we think our phone's there and it's not. And that's because we're desperate for the dopamine hit that comes when you hear a bleep. But some people have been leaving these tech firms recently and saying, what have we unleashed? We've built these addiction machines and now we've got these generations of people that are addicted to their phones. This is unethical. This is terrible. This is not doing no evil. This is an awful thing. So there's a bit of a pushback at the moment. And I hope we really turbocharge this, because if not, then we may need to think about some kind of legislation or regulation that's a bit like what we do with sugary foods or with other addictive
things.
Yeah,
I think if there's anything that I could, you know, if I could wave my magic wand, the thing I would change first of all is notifications, because I think notifications are the bane of all tech. I've been on a months-long quest
push notifications.
Now notifications worst of all, actually, because they break your concentration. Mm. And all the studies show there's no such thing as multitasking. Like, that's a lie. What happens is you just flip between one thing and another thing and you never actually deeply focus on anything. So I went through a phase where, you know, I've tried to turn everything off, but if you try and turn off your WhatsApp notifications, every sort of third time you then go into WhatsApp, it goes, are you sure you don't want to turn them on again? No, we had this conversation WhatsApp. I've turned off all my little, you know, those red circles of doom that haunt your dreams, where it just kind of tells you how many app updates you need to run or anything like that, because it's constantly knocking at you with this, like, well, this one, you know, like a little
slot
machine.
Make sure you don't forget to update your software, though, because... Yeah, that's the problem. Like, some of these notifications are really important. Like, you might have important patch notifications to update your software, so it carries on.
I am going to take that risk, because it's like, you know, minor bug fixes and improvements. Well, be a bit more specific. You know, what do you want from me? But I also think with something like WhatsApp, I just took the decision that actually, if anyone really, really needs me, they could phone me. I know the iPhone isn't actually that good as a phone of all the other things that it's brilliant at, but actually, I check WhatsApp enough times a day that I'm not likely to miss anything. And if someone really, really... Like, we had to redefine what it means if someone really needs to contact you immediately and get an immediate response for you. And I think the same is true of email. I don't have push emails on. I fetch my emails every so often.
Well, this is great stuff. These are the kind of recommendations that I'm making in the book. It's a conscious effort to try to regain your powers of attention and focus. And so you've got to actually do things to make that happen and try. And it's a struggle.
What do you do?
Really struggle. Well, I do a lot of the same things that you do.
I turn off
a lot of my notifications. Yeah. I say, I'm not going to check Twitter today. I'm not going to check this platform today. I'm going to spend the next hour reading this book, and I'm not going to keep worrying about whether I've received a retweet on my latest witty thing. What I'm trying to say in this book is that is hard work. Mm. It's hard. It's easily lost, that, but it's hard to win it back. But it's important that we do, and we understand that it does take effort.
Someone's done have made a version, like a plugin, where you can run a version of Twitter where it doesn't show you whether or not you've got any retweets. which is really interesting because it does take away that like, you know, when you think about Skinner boxes, all that science about behaviorism, about, you know, sort of pecking for a bit of corn, that is the problem with the retweet is a tiny bit of corn that you've been given and you gratefully eat it, but you want more corn. One of the things I tried.
There's never enough corn. There's never enough corn.
Is turning all my phone to which you can do deep buried down in settings on the iPhone. You can turn your phone monochrome. And that's surprisingly effective. It feels surprisingly low. Everything's low key. Well, because what you then realise is how much of your, you know, like particularly red is used as a signal on phones as a kind of, look at me, pay attention
urgent.
To me.
Yeah. Urgent.
And it's not urgent. It's never urgent.
No.
That's the really sad thing. I don't think I have more meaningful conversations now thanks to people being able to get in touch with me much easier than I did 10 years ago.
No, absolutely.
Do you feel like
I've got to try? So it's hard work because I am also addicted to these. Yeah. And that's the problem with it. It's that they're so good and they're so addictive and they're so brilliantly designed to play on those weaknesses.
Are we a divided generation? Because I'm 34. I don't know how you.
I'm 38.
Yeah. See, we're, and I think we're the kind of cuspy generation, right? I got my first mobile when I was maybe 15. It was like a Nokia 5110.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't get a. Well, obviously, I didn't get a smartphone until after I'd left university.
I didn't get a mobile until I was 18, so we probably had the same one if I'm 4 years older than you.
Playing a lot of Snake on it, secretly.
I was actually, when I think back, though, I was pretty addicted to Snake too.
I mean, that was epic.
Now you mention it.
But I just wonder if, you know, it's really interesting to think about how much, you know, I think we're the generation that's lived on both sides of that divide. Yeah. I don't know, we only got a computer with an internet connection in our house when I was 16. I think.
I think we're a very special generation, if I may say so. For having grown up without and then suddenly entered into adulthood with technology and really having seen how the world's changed and appreciate quite well what it is that we've lost and what it is that we've gained. So it's weird that the book idea that I had before this one was to explore that theme, like that one day my generation, our generation, will say to our grandchildren, you know, we remember what it was like before the internet. And they'll say, what? How did you ever get around without Google Maps? And we'll say, we got lost all the time. I don't really know how we did it, but we somehow managed, but it was okay.
We had payphones.
We had payphones, and we do all these brilliant things that we did, and we used to use jumpers for goalposts and all of that stuff. But so there'll be some rose-tinted glasses when we look back. But I wanted to explore that because I felt like we're in a very important demographic that understands very well both sides of that. And that didn't quite work out as an idea, but I think one day it will.
Why my generation is actually the specialist.
The best one, the special ones. Yeah. But it really did get me onto this subject of sort of what about this wonderful technology that we're all loving and addicted to? How is it disrupting democracy as well as everything else?
Well, let's come back and talk about some of the wider social implications, but we'll just have a short break.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared. And to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
And we're back. I'm Helen Lewis, and I'm talking to Jamie Bartlett about his new book and about technology in general. So we talked a bit about Facebook. I think we've really kind of brought Google into that, which, you know, those two, I think I naturally see them together because they are the duopoly of internet advertising. They occupy a huge amount of it. But other things that you're interested in, for example, driverless cars. So can I tell you my thing? I don't know if driverless cars will ever happen for the simple reason that they will save a lot of lives, I think, probably because a lot fewer road accidents will happen because of them, but they will kill people directly. And I don't think we're okay with robots killing people directly. I took the... Have you taken that test that's, I think, on the MIT website about trying to make your... Well, if you're a robot car, how do you program it to decide who it kills, right? And it's like, do you want to kill three criminals or this one woman with a baby? Yeah. Do you kill one child or one pirate?
Trolleyology. Well, there's a whole branch of philosophy dedicated to this.
The
trolley problem. Exactly. And I want to make sure that if I had a driverless car, that I would be able to program its ethical decision-making myself. So I would say, oh, absolutely value
you hate
the driver.
Oh, right. Okay.
The driver above the pedestrian, please, if you don't mind. So I imagine there'll be all sorts of interesting challenges that. But I actually kind of agree. I sort of feel like regulation and fear and insurance complications and the law will slow down the introduction of driverless cars a lot faster than the tech itself.
Yeah.
I think that's what will slow it down. And I kind of used that in the book, though, as an example of, you know, driverless cars was considered to be an impossible dream a decade ago by some of the world's leading AI researchers. And suddenly it looks pretty possible. Regulations and laws and problems notwithstanding, technologically it looks possible. And I did 150 kilometers in a driverless truck. Admittedly, it was on a very straight, boring American road where nothing happened. So you could probably just push a button and go straight anyway.
And there's lots of places like Australia in that. There are some of those truckers, you know, they just go on it. There's one road, there's just 100 miles of it.
They're the kind of places where it could work. It could be introduced quite helpfully. So you might have a sort of...
Haven't you just invented the train?
You've reinvented the train. You've reinvented the train.
That's the problem with that Uber. We know when they have the Uber thing and you kind of... It's still a bus.
And that always does well on Twitter, speaking of retweets, if you put that out,
it's
always
good. Guys, it's a bus.
But I used it really as an example to look at the speed with which the technology of AI is improving and getting better, and what the real problem is, I think, of the huge development of AI is not a jobless society where no one does work anymore, but a growing inequality between those who benefit from this tech and those who do not.
Right, so there's that famous phrase of, you know, in the future you're either going to work, you know, have a machine's work for you or work for a machine.
Yeah. And Mark Andreessen said that, a famous Silicon Valley entrepreneur, yeah.
Who invests a lot of money in stuff. He's got a fabulous personal aesthetic as well, I have to say. There's a great New Yorker profile of him. But I thought that was very interesting because AI is an area that I think is developing almost scarily fast. And it reminds me a little bit of the way that social media grew in the last decade without really having much, you know, and then the huge lag of then lawmakers keeping up with it. I mean, the Mark Zuckerberg testimony to Congress was alarming in many respects, not least of which were the people who would say, like, and when I'm emailing over WhatsApp, what do I do? And you thought, oh, my God.
Yeah. There's a baseline of knowledge necessary here. You don't need to have a PhD in computer science as a politician. I'd hate it if you did. But you need to know some of the...
Have you used a phone?
The very basics, at least.
And I think that with something like, deepfakes, right, is a really interesting... So they are. There is now image replication software in AI that can alter videos almost in real time. Certainly, you know, one of the ones that they in the paper that I read was they can take a video of a road in clear road conditions and they can put snow on it. Like you can, and it's, you know, it's not pixel perfect, but it looks like dash cam footage, right? So at low resolution. So they're now, you know, at the more sort of light-hearted end, because I imagine if it happens to you, it's horrible, but, you know, you can make fake celebrity pornography, right? You can simulate stuff. You can simulate a politician giving a speech. They've done Obama videos where they almost entirely fake them. So that is a huge challenge, the idea that in 10 years' time it could be possible to have news footage that you can simply no longer tell if it's real or fake.
Yes.
If you're going to talk about challenges to democracy,
absolutely.
That's a big one.
And I threw that in there, and it's going to be that people will trust nothing, or they'll trust everything, and more and more people will be trusting things on the basis of how they feel about it, and that's what really worries me. And we've got to shake up the way we teach this stuff. I know it's been said a lot now that critical thinking should be taught more in schools, and media literacy is arguably going to become the single most important subject you can learn at school now. And I think that's definitely true. We're still not teaching it anywhere near enough. However, it's not just a challenge of technology. It's not just about learning. Of course, kids should learn about how algorithms work, how machine learning works, how video manipulation works, all things that I think teachers do struggle to explain clearly because they never got taught this. They don't really know how this works. So we've got to really up the ability of teachers to teach this. But I think we're going to have to teach psychology as part of this as well, because so much of this also depends on how we make decisions in our own head. Like, why do we feel, you know, the cognitive biases that we have about why we believe one thing over another is probably more powerful than a Google algorithm or a Facebook newsfeed. So we're going to have to integrate old school critical thinking, new knowledge of technology with psychology as this like broad media literacy and increase massively the investment that we put into this. Because otherwise, I mean, I'm deeply, deeply worried about that. If there's no basis for a common understanding of reality, then democracy is just going to collapse.
Well, one of the things I found really interesting was your idea of this techno-authoritarians. And I know you've read David Runciman's stuff about the end of democracy. He's got a book coming out this summer and has given a lecture on this subject already. And his premise is, you know, we're not living through the new 1930s because everybody, you know, the average age in the Weimar Republic was 28.
20-something, yeah.
And
it's a young man's game, fascism.
Old people just support fascism, I think was his line. Yeah, they cheer it on from the sidelines. But also our GDP is so much higher. Well, for another project, I have been reading quite a lot of 1930s history. And the thing that strikes me that is similar, though, is the idea of complete chaos and runaway trains and kind of the feeling of not... I mean, obviously, we don't know well near the situation of Weimar Germany, which had, you know, hyperinflation followed by enormous, you know, unemployment at 7 million or, you know, a third of the population unemployed. Those challenges in Britain are not... are not there, but what there is this feeling of enormous overwhelm and of just of a blizzard of information coming at you and being far too much being kind of demanded of you. And in that circumstance, I can see why authoritarianism begins to look appealing to people, because you just basically say, I resign from all this, someone just tell me what to do.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is kind of quite relaxing.
Exactly, and that's exactly what I sort of project, this sort of horrible way that the promise of liberation ends up being flipped somehow. And a combination of this, yeah, overwhelming information, blizzard of conflicting facts and stories, but yeah, maybe not hyperinflation, but a possibility of a massive restructuring of our economy as we do move into the age of smart machines and millions of people out of work. And one day those millions of people may be in work, but doing what? And, you know, are the people that lose going to be the same people that win? We'll surely create new jobs with smart machines, but the people that lose their jobs might not be the ones that get the new ones. And so I think there could be some really, really difficult times ahead. And I kind of feel like we're seeing it a little bit already at the moment, the arrival of the strong men saying, I'll cut through all this rubbish, this crap, these politicians that say that problems are simple, as problems are difficult. They're not, they're simple and we can solve them. And I'm here to show you how. And what I fear is that I have a chapter about criminal justice. Well, not exactly about the criminal justice system, but the way that the amazingly exciting and liberating blockchain technology could also dramatically disable the ability of the police to actually do their job, and people lose faith in the ability of the criminal justice system because there's no way of enforcing certain laws when you have these immutable, perfect databases that can never be censored. Yeah. All of those things together do, to me, create this horrible moment where authoritarianism just looks more and more appealing.
I think there's more to it than that as well, in the sense of the social dimension of it, which is, first of all, you have, you know, we were all told that the internet would lead us to be kind of brains in jars and identity would be less important to us than ever. And that's really not what's happened. You know, you've seen a real resurgence of identity politics in, you know, which has always been a strand, and often people, when, you know, they'd never think of their own politics as identity politics. Identity politics is always something that's happening to someone else. But that's definitely been a feature of kind of internet discourse. I think you can see the Trump election partly as a response to having a black president, having Black Lives Matter, having a feeling that actually, you know, you have an African-American caucus that is asking for stuff and therefore the things are readjusting. And hyper-masculinity, which is such a weird feature of fascism throughout history, but now kind of comes back again. There's just been another quote-unquote incel killing, right? So this idea that comes from Reddit and 4chan of involuntary celibacy, which is also, I thought, was mostly known as your 20s, but apparently there's a proper there's a proper name for it.
It's a subculture. They call themselves incels. You know, I came across that in my book about the dark net, these sort of weird incel subcultures. And this is one of the, I don't know if you felt this, but I never identified myself as a kind of working class white man. But as other groups of people form identities that mean something to them, I'm left feeling like, well, what's my, you know, I need an identity. Actually, you know what? Mm. And I keep reading these statistics about how bad white men from comprehensive schools do. Well, I'm a white man from a comprehensive school, so that's my, you know, that's my group now. And I suddenly feel like I'm part of a subculture. And I never even gave this a thought 15 years ago. I wanted to be rid of all of that. So,
but it's also the sense that, I mean, you're different, your identity is less bounded, particularly because populations are so much more mobile and people move around a bit, right? You are dislocated from where you grew up. So when I was growing up, I was very firmly, you know, my parents in the states in the community and I was their child, right? And then you move to a different city or you're online and you're disconnected from that. So you have to find markers to,
yes, you
know,
you are.
Badges to put back on yourself.
Yes, exactly. And that's what Marshall McLuhan predicted would happen. 50 years ago, he said, when we could become electronic man rather than literate man, we'll go tribal again, because all of our sort of understood structures of identity and belonging will disappear and we'll be clamoring around trying to find a new identity. And I think that's partly what's happened, and you can see a lot of positives in that, but if it goes too far, it starts really undermining democracy, because two warring tribes can't really ever compromise or even talk to each other. And this is one of the things that I think people get wrong about echo chambers and filter bubbles online. The idea that we're stuck in these little information wells that we've created, convincing ourselves and surrounding ourselves with like-minded people saying the same thing over and over again. I don't find that to be the case. I find that I'm surrounded on the internet by idiots. Everywhere I look, there's an idiot. And I what I do, and what I think most of us do, is and it's more powerful than an echo chamber, is to dismiss my opponents as fools and morons. And I don't engage with their ideas properly, and I sort of immediately assume that they're acting in bad faith, and they assume the same of me. But often because our interactions, and this is why it's worse than echo chambers, because it's baked in to the internet's design, the interaction with these strangers is very short and fleeting. So you never really understand where people are coming from. You're very easy to dismiss them. You get angry with each other very, very quickly. And that's not about being in an echo chamber. That's about being confronted with opposing views. And the liberal theory is, oh, opposing views, you talk them out and you come to a conclusion and we all get along very well. And unfortunately, that hasn't really happened.
Yeah, there's a couple of other things I think play into that. And the first is the difficulty of communicating through text.
Yes, yes.
And that is just a fundamentally unnatural thing for humans to do. You lose all we call the kind of phatic qualities of speech, you know, gesture, tone, you know, sarcasm, the need for a sarcasm font continues.
We'd be screaming at each other if this conversation had taken place over...
Well, and also it would be weirdly asynchronous, right? If this conversation was happening over Twitter, I wouldn't listen to your whole answer before start. You know, you'd probably say one thing, I'd say something else, and I think of something else to butt into that, and then you'd be trying to respond to those 2 points. Then some other randomer would come in and shout at one of us. You know, those platforms, particularly Twitter, which is, I know, actually a relatively small usage platform, but I think it's important because it's where political journalists hang out, commentators hang out, quote-unquote opinion formers grow, hang out. So it does have a disproportionate influence on how these things are talked about. Is if you were going to design the sort of enragement machine, you couldn't do a lot better than Twitter. But also it's a problem of scale. I think this is the thing, is that there's never been a real acknowledgement that, you know, Dunbar's number, this idea that the maximum size of your kind of group is determined by the size of your brain, and he's done it through primates, and you can kind of see that we kind of go from kind of, I'm going to say crappy primates. I'm sure they're all lovely primates in their own ways, but, you know, less intelligent primates have smaller groups, and you get a bit. And then the prediction would be that the average human group size is about 150. And I think they've then applied that to Facebook, saying the average number of friends someone's got is 150. Yeah. But actually, you just can't form relationships with that many more people than that. You can't take into account that many more people's opinions. And I think it's one of the reasons that I get so defensive on the internet. It's just, you just get a lot more noise, you know, and you just can't keep, you have to somehow at some point just wall yourself off from that. Mm. So this great, supposedly great democratizing machine that was going to allow you to bring into contact and hear many more views. Well, there's only so many views that you can hear in a day, right?
Yes, but, and I think that's it. The original, I actually spent some time on a commune that was desperately trying to get above Dunbar's number and just could not grow beyond 150. I think it's a very important an interesting tool analysis. I know it's slightly disputed sometimes, but I found it fascinating when I also saw that Facebook average number of friends or meaningful friends is about 150, because we don't have the cubic capacity in our brains to understand not just the relationships between us and them, but between amongst them as well. This, I think, comes to the core of the problem, which is in the 90s, the techno-utopians thought that if we had more information, more data, more connectivity, it would be a way of banishing misunderstanding, that we'd get along better because we'd know what each other thought, we'd be able to share ideas, and they thought politics would become far more rational and more objective. And maybe it's because a lot of them were computer scientists, where more information is always good to program into your software. You know, it's not the same problem. But obviously what's happened is once you get to a certain level of information, it becomes overwhelming. You can't rely on your careful, rational, logical brain anymore because it's so overwhelmed. And you have to start relying on your emotional heuristics and your cognitive biases to just decide to dismiss all those people because they're idiots and they're in the wrong tribe. Or, you know, the confirmation bias problem where we see stuff and decide that it must be true because we already thought that anyway. You have almost no choice but to rely on those mechanisms to make sense of the overwhelming amount of noise. And I don't think anyone working in technology in the 90s ever thought that would be a problem.
Right, which is a kind of analogous to pre-crash economics, right? And the whole idea of classical economics relying on, you know, Homo economicus, these people making very rational decisions having looked at the information. And then now the science of economics is thankfully lightly shaken by the idea that actually people often don't act in rational ways at all. They often have extremely imperfect information and they don't act in the, you know, they don't actually even act in their own best interests sometimes. You know, we are all incredibly herd oriented, right?
And yes.
The point that Michael Lewis makes very well in The Big Short is that, you know, lots of people should have seen that those mortgages were junk and worthless, but well, everyone else is buying them. They must be good. And it, you know, the case he makes very strongly there is it's the oddballs who, for one reason, see themselves against the system, who are the ones who have the courage to go, well, the emperor is never going to make that repayment because the emperor has spent it all down the bookies.
Well, basically. I'm hopefully the oddball here. But actually, you know, more and more people, I think, are coming to the same conclusions. And people, it's definitely the last year, you know, how you started off this podcast saying that things feel like they've already started changing. You know, people are really worried about this. They're pushing back against this. But one of the interesting things about this irrationality online is that higher educated people are more subject to these irrationalities.
I don't see that can be true. It's one of those things where I read it and you kind of go, no, I think you're fine. If you've got a degree, then you're probably fine from all this stuff. I think that's really fascinating. Do you have any idea why that is?
Well, I have a theory, which is that highly educated people are more easily persuaded by their own powers of reason and they convince themselves that they're so wise and above these things. Just to give you, I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but my sort of Remain voting friends, and I'm not saying Remain voting people are clever and Brexit voting,
but it is correlated with educational attainment for lots of very sensible reasons about how the job market has benefited graduates disproportionately over the last 10 years.
Remain voting people have often said to me, oh, the people that voted for Brexit, it was just all emotional. It was all on gut. They weren't thinking about it. They didn't really know the facts. And I say to them, what do you know about how the European Union
works? What's our fisheries policy?
And they don't know anything. And they voted on the same basis, which was it was the tribe I felt that I most liked to belong to, that it said something about who I thought I was. And yet it was very easy to point fingers at, and both sides are pointing fingers at each other, saying, neither of you know, you know, you guys don't know what you're doing. But we're all in our own ways subject, I think, to these biases and these problems of reasoning.
There's been some very unpleasant kind of, you know, if only you could, the scales could fall from your eyes, you could see that this is the one true way. And I think that's difficult as well. It also just comes back to another problem we've been alluding to the other time, is that humans are very bad at knowing that other people are not them, right? That other people have different viewpoints. And the fact
is other people.
Yeah, but yeah. The fact is, you know, if you are a graduate, you know, in a big city, the shape of your opportunities over the last 20 years in Britain has been very different than if you left school at 16 and you live in a seaside town. Your realities are fundamentally different and your incentives and rewards are fundamentally different.
Yes.
You've experienced two almost completely different economies.
We have to try to bridge that somehow. We have to do something. Because the book is fundamentally about the internet. I mean, I say smash your own echo chambers, try to get out there, try to actually meet people offline, see where they might be coming
from. In real life,
there are real human beings out there that have very different experiences to you, go and find them, go and meet them, go and listen to them. I've been privileged to be able to do that in some of my work, right? I spent time a couple of years ago with all sorts of fringe political movements from across the spectrum, and it's amazing. And every single group is as convinced as the next that they have the one true path. And not only that, everybody else who doesn't understand where they're coming from is a government patsy or a spy or an idiot or a moron or malevolent or whatever. And
that's a good corrective to see lots of people who think they're from different sides. We're getting towards the end of our time. So I think we should leave people with a bit of a reading list. What are the things that you have read or watched that have helped you really understand the effect of the internet on society at the moment? I mean, I can kick you off by saying that I think that the work of Adrian Chen, who's now at The New Yorker, used to be at Gabe Gawker, has been really good. He's done some great work on content moderation, which I think is something we don't talk about. This is the invisible labor of the internet.
Right. You know,
people who have to look at all the ISIS beheading videos or all of the horrific, weird porn that people post on stuff. And I think, you know, Google is now saying that actually their algorithms are getting much better for extremist content. It's easier to identify porn. I think you just look for quite a lot of skin tone, basically. But it's much harder to identify, you know, jihadi content, for example. So that's something I think is really interesting, the invisible labour of the internet to read about. And I think John Herman's work at the New York Times about the hyper-partisan nature of Facebook has been really good. He's a writer. I will read anything that he writes. But who are those people for you?
Well, I'm interested in finding very strange fringe movements and ideas that are actually weirdly saying something to us now. Mm. So the work of Marshall McLuhan is still very, very good.
The only thing is that you say Marshall McLuhan and I just think of Annie Hall and like that argument in the you know, when he goes like, this is what Marshall McLuhan thinks, and he's like, and then Marshall McLuhan himself comes on to say he's an idiot.
Yes.
But is it worth
reading? Yeah, I struggle with it. It's quite difficult, some of his work. But the summaries of, I mean, I know this is going to make me sound very lazy, but the summaries of his work, I mean, he gave an amazing interview in Playboy magazine, of all places, mm-hmm. in 1969, where he was really trying to predict how electronic media would change society. It's a 10,000-word interview. It's incredibly insightful. It's so interesting. So I'm very interested at the moment at reading things that are not of the exact moment, but look a bit further ahead. So here's a weird one for you. I recommend that people try to read Ted Kaczynski's Unabomber Manifesto.
You mentioned this.
It's a 40,000-word rant. A lot of it is ridiculous. Ted Kaczynski, for anyone that doesn't know, killed three people in the 1990s with a series of letter bombs, injured many more, because he thought that technology was... He's kind of the last of the neo-Luddites. He thought that technology was oppressing freedom and was going to destroy society. And at the time when he wrote it in the 90s, it sounded like the wild lunacies of a madman. But strangely enough, if you read it now, some of his predictions about where society would end up feel weirdly prescient. I'm not suggesting for a second that anyone would follow his methods, but he made a series of quite amazing predictions about we'd have a small number of tech mega monopolies that would be run on data that would start controlling politics because they'd become so wealthy that people would become addicted to these machines, that we would begin to lose the ability to act with our free will because algorithms would be nudging us. And I'm reading it thinking, my goodness me, that madman was actually right about some of this stuff. And another, for those who are more technically inclined, Siphonomicon, which is another 50,000-word blog by a man called Timothy May, the original cypherpunk, which went on to inspire Julian Assange, Nick Szabo, who was behind smart contracts, Satoshi Nakamoto, who invented Bitcoin.
If he really exists.
If he really exists, whoever he is or whoever they are. Mm. He wrote this very, very interesting and weird quasi-technical blog about how public key encryption and its wide availability to people would fundamentally undermine the powers of governments to enforce their will on people. This was in 1992, 1993.
So the idea of public key encryption is you have half a key, basically, that you give out in public, and therefore, you know, people can send you stuff under that encryption, and only you can unlock it because you've got the private
half. Exactly. It allows you to publicly share your encryption key with others so everyone can see it, but that's not an old-style encryption. I mean, if you sent out the cipher, everyone, the governments and everyone else, would be able to then unlock your messaging. But with public key encryption, that doesn't work, due to some weird mathematical properties I don't really understand related to prime numbers. But it's another one of these weirdly visionary, crazy blogs that at the time no one listened to, but he was predicting the rise of cryptocurrencies and how hard it would be to monitor them, and governments would struggle to, you know, raise taxes if everyone had these encrypted currencies, and you could have anonymous marketplaces on a dark market, which came to pass 20 years later with the Silk Road on the dark net. And again, you look at those longer trends, and I think you can learn something very interesting above and beyond the I agree, amazing work by people like Adrian Chen.
And then finally, let's have a couple of people, like people to watch. This is our kind of little version of the Time Person of the Year. In terms of the people who are at the cutting edge of tech, who you kind of, you know, you need to know about in order to understand some of this stuff, who would you name? I mean, I think this is very worrying. That immediately, all the people who come to my mind are all men. So I would say like Demis Hassabis of DeepMind, or Peter Thiel, Marc Andreessen in terms of investors in Silicon Valley, or you know what I mean? It's a very Elon Musk, who, you know, has parlayed his enormous fortune into, already now he's very into driverless cars and private space exploration. He said, I want to die on Mars, just not on impact, and that kind of thing. These are to me the god kings of Silicon Valley, right? Mm. Who do you think you need to know about in order to understand where we're kind of going in terms of this stuff?
Well, I've really enjoyed watching Damian Collins, the Select Committee chair, because I think they're doing a great job at showing how politicians are, like, the level of knowledge needed for a politician to hold tech companies to account. And he's got I think he studied history or something like this. He's not a techie, but he's really worked hard to understand how this technology works. I think they're doing an amazing job on that. So politically, I'm watching him. I think he's very interesting, and watching how he's figured these things out. The people that I like watching, as you might have guessed, are those weird fringe people. I mean, probably the most important, it is a man again, is Vitalik Buterin, who invented Ethereum.
Which is another cryptocurrency.
Another version, a kind of a cryptocurrency with added bonuses, that it's not just about a currency, it's a kind of a platform that you can run all sorts of different apps on. Those in the know watch him very carefully. He was 19 when he built this Ethereum
cryptocurrency. This stuff is all so upsetting. Like, the guy who runs Spotify is about 12.
Yeah, I know. They're getting, I know. It's incredible, isn't it?
Tech billionaires get younger every year.
Yeah, they do, don't they? And yeah, and then suddenly, at the age of like 22, he's worth $500 million or something. But he still travels around the world with a backpack and no money in his pocket. And he's very critical of his own invention as well. He's a really interesting person, sometimes a little bit technical, but philosophically, he's a fascinating person.
Well, there we go. We sent you away with some homework and some people to watch. And if you want to explore these themes more, in Jamie's new book, The People versus Tech, How the Internet is Killing Democracy, that is out now. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you.